are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we review the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters. In the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet, it gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God, for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say, Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity. Everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future, we all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. You say, Ashe? We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe. Civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say, Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say, Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted, and we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood. together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. Hotel family, hope everything is well with you today. Hope you're going to have a good day today. You know, it is Wednesday, hump day. Got to get over the hump. But I hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, must do, should do, can do, will do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But if it isn't, I know you'll get it done anyway, because you always persevere. Appreciate you for that. This is African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, or any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives, timeforanawakening.com. When you get onto the page, look for podcast, click on that, and then once you click on that, there'll be African Perspectives right at the top. Click on that, and there will be programs that are dated and titled. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media. This program, once again, is every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. All times are going to give our Eastern times. On Mondays, Acres of Diamonds, public affairs programming out of Philadelphia, Brother Wahad, from 6 to 8. Followed by Let's Buy Black, 365, from 8 to 9. And then Conversations, Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey from 9 to 10. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10. This evening, Wednesday, from 8 to 10 as well, Revive with Sister POC, Proof of Consciousness. And then Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy at 7 p.m. If it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern, yeah, that's right, y'all. It's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, Fridays at 8 p.m. On Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., it's not me. No, it's not. It is Sister POC and her program Revive on Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then Sunday evening, it's time for an awakening once again with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Every Monday through Friday from 10 p.m. Eastern to 12 a.m., it's the Warren Ballantyne Show right here on Time for an Awakening Media. And the number to call is always 215-490-9832, 215-490-9832. We Buy Black. WeBuyBlack.com. Get everything you need from WeBuyBlack.com. I'm looking at the website right now, and they have all these nice products that are produced by us. You know, of course, they're trying to get a grocery store, so they're asking all the brothers and sisters to donate so they can have this grocery store, that we supermarket, where the products and the produce will be produced by us. I think it's great. You know, they got the Champ boxer shorts. They got the grooming stuff. They got, you know, high quality for beard products. And, you know, they got, what else they got here? They got a lot of good stuff here. The toothbrushes that were created by us. Yeah, okay. And then, of course, they want you to, and then there's a lot of products. When you go on the website, you know, the laundry detergent that is produced by us, True Laundry Detergent. Then they got a lot of stuff for sale, like, you know, creams and lotions and facial care products, the toothpaste, activated charcoal facial cleanser. Some of their best sellers are the
natural deodorants, and of course the toothbrushes and the laundry detergent and natural mouthwash and tooth powder. And then they got feature stuff that, you know, clothing and gifts, all kinds of good stuff, brothers. So go online. Go online. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses from WeBuyBlack.com. WeBuyBlack.com. Africa for the Africans. Brother Bomani Tayemba. AfricaForTheAfricans.org. Go on his website. He has, once again, four trips this year. Senegal and Gambia, April 3rd to the 13th, $3,300. Ghana Repatriation and Investment, May 25th to June 5th, $3,700. South African Roots and Cultural, November 20th to November 30th for $3,700. Ghana Repatriation and Investment, December 24th to January 5th for $3,700. And then first thing next year, in April of next year, April 2nd to April 12th, once again going back to Senegal and Gambia for $3,500. Put a down payment down, pay on it, make it easy on yourself, but more importantly, you're able to go to the motherland. Also, too, everything that you will need, all information that you will need about how you can make sure that you access this trip properly is on the website. The forms that you need to fill out, everything, the visas, whatever is necessary, is on the website. Go to AfricaForTheAfricans.org. I couldn't bring up Renoco. I know this is in October. He's going to Uganda and Rwanda. And then he's going to Kemet. He's going to Egypt. He's going to Kemet. He's been doing a lot of good research. It was so good to see him a few weeks ago. And he looked good, and I've been seeing his posts. If you're on Facebook, if you have Facebook, make sure you follow Brother Renoco. Follow Brother Renoco, okay? If you're on Facebook. So, Habasha. Habasha. That's right, brothers and sisters. Habasha. Habasha is helping Africa by establishing schools at home and abroad. Habasha. And go to the Habasha website, HABESHA.org. INC.org. I want to make sure I get it right so you go there and you'll see the beautiful work that they are doing. I mean, fantastic. You know, the Kashi village, and of course, the mission of Habasha is a pan-African organization that cultivates leadership in youth and families through practical experiences in cultural education, sustainable agriculture, entrepreneurship, holistic health, and technology. Programs are the Habasha Works, where you get out there and you deal with the land. Back to our roots. Sustainable seeds. All of this is, you know, even the golden growers. That's something that I can get into, you know. And then, of course, the Kashi Project, which is in Ghana, honoring Dr. Kwaku Adora, who was a botanist, and they're honoring him. And they're doing, the work is being done. They still need funding. And the reason why I make these announcements is that you hopefully will go there, patronize them, go online and look at them, do whatever it is that you feel you need to do, because we need support in all these areas. Shrine of the Black Madonna. The Shrine of the Black Madonna, located here in the West End in Atlanta. I'm Ralph David Abernathy. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 12 to 7, Sunday from 1 to 3. Number to call is 404-549-8676. 404-549-8676. They got everything. They got furniture. They got clothing. They got artwork. They got the red, black, and green shoes and the guy's shoes. But more importantly, they got books. And if they don't have the book that you're looking for, believe me, they'll get it for you. And they also have an African Holocaust Museum. They also have a history class every Saturday from 1:30 to 3:30. know thyself. Brother Baba Olatunji, outstanding job. Know thyself. And if you want that information, the multimedia library is there for you. That's right. You can have it on disk. There's now 7 terabytes of African enlightenment. 7 terabytes. Man, you have a lot of information, brother. Believe me, I got the 4.5, so I'm down 2.5. So I got an update for what's going on. Shrine of the Black Madonna. Medu Bookstore, the Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall, located in the Greenbrier Mall. It is open Monday through Saturday from 10 to 9, and then Sunday from 12 to 6. The number to call, Sister Mama Nia, call Mama Nia at 404-346-3263. 404-346-3263. She has a fine selection of books, postcards, greeting cards, T-shirts, all kinds of good stuff at the Medu Bookstore. I'll be announcing when I'm going to do my presentation there. Hope for those who are in the Atlanta area who are listening will come on out and participate. It's going to be real soon. Won't be, of course, anytime this week. It'll barely be a little after that. I'll announce it because this Friday I won't be broadcasting. Friday I'll be in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but I'm going to go through that in a minute. Let me finish these announcements and talk about my good friend Kazinde Ajamu at the Black Dog Cultural Center and Bookstore in Lithonia. Give him a call at 404-519-8107. 404-519-8107. He has books. He also has the red, black, and green shoes, the NASGAS, the gas shoes. So check him out if you're in the Lithonia area. Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative for our people in the spirit of Ujamaa. Cooperative economics. So as we like to say, family-centered economics. They have their Thursday night broadcast tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio. The number to call is 929-477-2789. 929-477-2789. Next weekend, brothers and sisters, they will have the conference March 13th through the 15th here in Atlanta. The conference is going to be at the Interdenominational Theological Center, located on the campus of Morris Brown here in Atlanta. The address is, 700 Martin Luther King Jr. Drive here in Atlanta. And so I'm quite sure they're going to be talking about it tomorrow night on the radio broadcast, the Ulu broadcast. And I'm going to get Baba Akima or somebody here to talk about it next week, more than likely on that. But he named me next week, Thursday. I'll have somebody come in and we'll discuss the conference. It's going to be a very serious conference because we desperately need to talk about how we can make Ulu really happen for us. You know? All right. Ackerman Institute. That's right, Baba Baruti and Sister Ya Baruti have been doing an outstanding job of educating our young warriors. And I'm saying to us, we need to support that. Okay? We need to support that. I know, public schools, tax dollars, and so forth. But in this situation, don't you remember, and still happens, that some of our people who believe that Caucasians can have more information, educate better facilities and so forth, and they put thousands of dollars. And some of those students still don't come away properly educated. Let's be real. But Ackerman Institute is doing an outstanding job and they need our support. So make your check or money order out to Ackerman Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia 30310. That is Ackerman Institute, P.O. Box 10786, 30310. But if you want to use Cash App or PayPal, you can do so too. $ Yah, YAMMBARUTI, Baruti, and make that happen. Okay? Make that happen. Sanjay-Aidi.org. Sister Gabriela Aurelia. Sister Gabby has been, she sent me, I told you, a bunch of pictures the other day. I mean, like 30 pictures. But just proving that they are doing great work. They're doing great work in the northeastern portion, in the rural areas of Haiti. And yes, they need our support. I mean, beautiful. They deal with education for these young folks, health, and entrepreneurship, and sustainability, agricultural sustainability. They have a chicken farm. They're doing all kinds of great things, brothers and sisters, and they need support. And so go online to Sonjay, S-O-N-J-E, dash, Haiti, A-Y-I-T-I.org. Sonjay-Haiti.org. The M-Yay Say-Sim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. March 3rd. The black man in this new cultural container imitates the European man who basically dislikes women, Dr. John Henry Clark. I'm sure most of us have not met or know African people who show no evidence of an African self anywhere. There was nothing in their walk, talk, voice, manner, associates, interests, style, loyalties, and analysis, and especially eyes that spoke to their having an African center. In fact, everything about them pointed toward having an extreme European orientation. These individuals had so fully assimilated the European they love and worship more than life itself, and they had literally lost themselves. They see no connection with the rest of us. They have no recognition of us as family. I imagine if they had their druthers, as most of the African characters in George Schuyler's Black No More, they would do anything, including selling their souls, to have a white exterior to match their emptiness inside. Affirm, Africa is nowhere evident in me. Excuse me, I read it wrong. Affirm, Africa is everywhere evident in me. I repeat, affirm, Africa is everywhere evident in me. If you know me, or you see me, that's right. I'm 24/7. I've been that way for a long time. I don't do stuff fashionably. I'm trying to help us change our minds. I'm trying to release the African mind. I'm trying to reconnect us. I'm trying to get us to understand how important it is to be one. So there that is. You know what I'm saying? Know what I'm saying? March 4th. Did you ever hear a bird in a cage tell his master that he intended to making his escape? ASAP. We have been trained to alert Europeans of our revolutionary activities beforehand. The condition need to be seen as publicly broadcast. Everything we are about to do betrays the possibilities of us being victorious in the face of those who have made a mission of watching our every move for any signs of rebellion. Some things should not be known beyond a few who have a blood-sworn silence. If others knew you have a secret, then you no longer have a secret. Most of our greatest nation-building workers are of a few words. On the other hand, renowned sub-integrationists and interracialists have betrayed critical tactical details to those who should not know. We find them always running to the enemy to have their voice validated. What is the single most consistent piece of evidence that someone is a guerrilla? You do not know he or she is one. I repeat, what is the single most evident piece of, single most consistent piece of evidence that someone is a fighter for our liberation is that you do not know he or she is one. No slogans, no models, no insignias, no ranks, no dues, no broadcasting, no public pronouncements of intentions, no evidence outside concrete results, no visibility. Revolutions are enacted, not debated. They are not a point of conversation except to discuss strategies and tactics for immediate implementation. Revolutions are not something for tomorrow. They are to be done now. What possible questions are there when you know your enemy and know that they will never stop until there is no longer any evidence of your existence? What possible questions are there when you know your enemy and know that they will never stop until there's no longer any evidence of your existence? A wise warrior knows to work below the radar at all times. Affirm, I keep vital secrets. Affirm, I keep vital secrets. Your secrets are safe with me. I was going through some stuff and I saw Brother Lester Velt Middleton. Lester Velt Middleton did some outstanding interviews with our great scholars. One of the first I seen was with Dr. Asa Hilliard, Nana Baba Kofu. Then I seen one with Shiganta Diop, and then a round table with Dr. Ben, Dr. Clark, and Ivan Von Sertima. Brother Lester Velt Middleton, he's an ancestor as well. But I saw a quote, and I'm not sure if it's his personally or whatever. It doesn't make a difference, but it's an outstanding quote. Lester Velt Middleton. In fact, brothers and sisters, please go on YouTube. Put in Brother Lester Velt Middleton's name. Lester Velt Middleton's name. And look at some of the great interviews that he has done with some outstanding scholars, some great ancestors. The quote, "We must not be the people who walked but left no footprints, who talked but had nothing meaningful to say, who labored but built nothing for themselves. And so we lay at your feet, the builders, spade and shovel, the masons, troll and square, Africa's books of wisdom. Go now and build for eternity." Ashe, ashe. We must not be the people who walked but left no footprints, who talked but had nothing meaningful to say, who labored but built nothing for themselves. And so we lay at your feet, the builder's spade and shovel, the mason's trowel and square, Africa's books of wisdom. Go now and build for eternity. Ashe, ashe, ashe. To be truly liberated, African people must come to know the nature of European thought and behavior in order to understand the effects of the Europeans has had on our ability to think victoriously. We must be able to separate our thoughts from Europeans' thoughts so as to visualize a future that is not dominated by Europe. This is a demand by an African-centered view because we are Africans and because the future towards which Europe leads us is genocide. And see, the problem I know that we have with that is that we don't believe that. Oh, I mean, you know, we do, those who are listening and those who ourselves, but I'm talking about our people, African people. Even on the continent and elsewhere, we don't believe, because we don't want to believe that. We've been trained not to believe that. And so therefore, the idea of being African and doing things for Africa and working with nobody but Africans is something that for them is just, no, I can't, that can't happen. They're squeamish. They don't want that to happen. Usually I read Kwame Nkrumah, and I'll do that again because I always want to read Kwame Nkrumah, those two quotes, because it is real. It is real to what I discuss on this program in terms of Pan-Africanism. It is real to the plight of where we are today, even though it was said over 60 years ago. But it's real. It is most real. Today, we're going to talk about Tulsa, Oklahoma, the the massacre that happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921. We talked yesterday on Monday about other massacres that happened, and there were many. There were many, brothers. I just picked out a few, saw an article on a few of them, but there were so many. In fact, last year, 2019, because of 1619 to 2019, the 400 years, marking the 400 years of our physical and mental captivity, the mental captivity persists. And we were talking about, you know, in terms of where are we? 400 years, now what? And so we didn't talk too much about 100 years ago, 1919. The red hot summers of 1919, of multiple cities going up in flames, where Caucasians, once again, I mean, damn y'all, once again, vamp on our communities. You know, our disturbances of the 60s were tearing up our neighborhood out of pain and frustration, burning buildings. And of course, Lord knows, I'm quite sure if a Caucasian was in the area and he didn't have a weapon or something on him, his ass was grass and we was the lawnmower, you know, because that's the kind of frustration that was built. But prior to that, what I'm talking about is mean-spirited ugliness of Caucasians vamping on our communities, giving anything as a justification to do it, mainly some Caucasian woman being accosted or assaulted or even raped. They would come in and they just vamp on the community and destroy. Go into the vandalize, take whatever they want, and then destroy the community, either put us in containment or kill us if we didn't get a chance to escape. You know, we talked about Elaine, Arkansas, Rosewood, Atlanta. You know, somebody asked me, did I ever take, my sister Hakina. She asked me, did I ever take the history of Sweet Auburn Avenue. Now, of course, if you're familiar with Atlanta, Sweet Auburn Avenue is the main street of the activity of Atlanta's American African community from way back when to even today. You know, Dr. King's home is on Auburn Avenue, and the King Center, the Ebenezer Baptist Church. You know, there's a number of places and things on Auburn Avenue. And, you know, so, but once again, I'm talking about at a time where Caucasians would be frustrated and looking at us doing well with ourselves, you know. And what's interesting, because of that devastation, even today, now, they also ruined some communities that were pretty tight. By running an expressway like they did in Milwaukee and a few other places, Chicago, the Raleigh-Durham community, the Hittite community of Raleigh-Durham, another very thriving American-African community where the money that went into that community would circulate in that community like it did in Rosewood, you know, 8 or 9 times before it left that community. Today, the money comes into our hands and it is gone. It doesn't circulate with us. Very few of us go to particularly here in Atlanta, go to a service station that is owned by us, a cleaners that is owned by us, a supermarket that is owned by us. I could go on. Now, we can go to some nice restaurants. Like, unlike some places, there are some nice restaurants that you can go to here in Atlanta that are owned by us. You know, of course, salons and barbershops, of course, you know. Funeral homes. Now, you know, there's been stated that some of the funeral homes were fronts for Caucasians. And because they know that brothers and sisters don't want their loved ones
to be buried by others because they want to make sure they're looking right. I never forget when this brother named Fred Gray, his wife was Caucasian. She had him, and I don't know, they, you know, they probably didn't have much money. He was kind of big dude. They looked like they just put his ass, they stuffed him in that casket, and his makeup was terrible. I told my ex, I said, hey, don't you ever let, well, I have different orders upon my transition, but don't you ever, man. And so, you know, so we have some businesses, and some of the businesses is that really, you know, others don't want, but I mean, in terms of stores, getting our money, oh, please. I don't know, I don't even know of a service station, convenience store that is ours in this metropolitan area. I don't. I really don't. You know, I know we have one left in Milwaukee, Sister Diane. Hold on, dear. She's located on 8th and Atkinson. And I remember when there were many of those places in Milwaukee. Many. I can remember right now about 5, 7 of them, if not more. They're all gone. Only one left is Sister Diane. And she's holding on. You know. In fact, really, if the consciousness level was there, she should be just overflowing with business. She should have to open up another service station or 2 or 3. Because she should be getting that much business. But because we don't have our right minds and we have no feeling for one another, because we have bought into what America is about, individualism, materialism, greed, and violence. And so we don't participate with one another. We don't share with one another. We don't support one another. We don't trust one another. We don't love one another. We don't want to deal with one another. And what must be understood, this is not something that we do automatically. This is something as we've been trained to do. This is something that those who are in control hope and wish we will always do. Because by doing so, they can continue to do what they do. So in 1921, you know, Oklahoma was where indigenous people and us who had escaped our captivity going into Florida, into Seminole territory, and Andrew Jackson, and I hate Andrew Jackson. God, I hate that man. Of course, I never met him. But I hate Andrew Jackson. I mean, all of them. I hate all of the presidents. Let me just be real. Hit all of them, but Andrew Jackson. And so Andrew Jackson was the one that went down into Florida after many times that the United States tried, but he was the one that went down in there and finally made it happen to eradicate the people out of Florida, the indigenous people, the so-called Seminoles, and Africans. Now, understand something. This is documented that some of the brothers and sisters that moved into that area were also reduced to servitude by the indigenous people. That's true. You know. So the indigenous people and the Africans were marched, were taken from Florida all the way to Oklahoma on the Trail of Tears. The Trail of Tears. Now, you know, I don't like to use the word tribes.
And this call is being recorded.
And nor does the indigenous people like to use the word tribe. They use nations, just like Europeans, you know. But for us, it's tribe. No, don't use tribe. We're not tribe. We're nations. And so the indigenous people in the Southeast, particularly in Florida, and us, we were being marched for miles, hundreds and hundreds of miles, to Oklahoma. One of the first cities that were established by us, American Africans, was Boley, Oklahoma. Boley, Oklahoma. But the one that thrived, the one that was just dynamic for us, was Tulsa. Tulsa, Oklahoma. And there were some defined lines. They had a railroad track, a defined line. There was a railroad track. And this railroad track kind of helped divide the city. And so segregation, just like everything else, Jim Crow, all of that was real. I'm talking about 1921. But yet, the brothers and the sisters in Tulsa, they were employing each other. They had built businesses. Sometimes, I'm quite sure, even Caucasians bought from them. They had multiple number of businesses. Not just a barbershop and a beauty salon like we do today. Hardware stores. General stores or grocery stores. Hotels. Oh, I could go on. Theater. It was a self-contained community. I say that if a community, to be a true community, if you say you're a good community and you have, to me, you should have at least four things. You should have a bank to put your money. A bank. You should have a hospital for health reasons and for birth. A hospital that is yours. You should have a school that educates, you know, your people. You know. You should have at least those things. A hospital, a bank, a school, and a supermarket, a grocery store. If you have those four things, a supermarket, and just like what We Buy Black is trying to do, have a supermarket where American African growers, farmers, can bring their produce and so forth and sell it in our supermarket. And whatever other brothers and sisters have, grocery stores, canneries, all those things can bring them to that supermarket. And we would go there and buy on a weekly, monthly basis. That's what needs to happen. That's when you know you have a thriving community. If you at least have those four things, and they had those four things and then some. I didn't mention churches. I ain't going to go with no damn churches, okay? We got plenty churches, and we pause. Because the churches, unlike, let's say, churches like Father Divine, or Daddy Grace. Father Divine fed his people and the community during the Depression. That's serious outreach of a church. I don't even see that. Because especially the bigger churches, they're not outreach. They're preaching prosperity gospel. The pastor is rich. The pastor lives lavishly. The parishioners, mostly women, they say, my pastor, he got to have a nice car. My pastor got to look good. He my pastor. I ain't going to go further with that. I'm going to just go somewhere else. I'm going to go back to what we're talking about, and that is, of course, the massacre of Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921. But that's what those brothers and sisters did, and it showed that that's what you could do. Today, there is not one community in America where African Americans, or American Africans, as I like to call us, we're American Africans, we control that community. By that, I mean we have at least those four things, a bank, a school, a hospital, and a supermarket. But we have all other things that would make a community that are run by us. We may have the cleaners. We may have a laundromat for those who don't have a washer and dryer in your homes. Everything that we need, a department store, manufacturing. I mean, you know, that's why when I promote We Buy Black, I talk about the products that they have, and they have a lot. And you need to go to that website and check them out. And more importantly, you need to support it, purchase them, you know? So the jealousy of Europeans, the jealousy of Europeans, the meanness, the envy, the mean-spiritedness, the hatefulness, the selfishness, the greediness. When they seen that community just like Rosewood. John Singleton's movie Rosewood with Ving Rhames, and ironically with John Voight as one of the heroes, who's a Trump supporter, Trump lover. He's in the movie as the guy who helps some of our people get on this train that gets them out of Rosewood. Didn't know about Rosewood until the 80s. I didn't. Because they had taken Rosewood off the map. But to the people of Tulsa, Oklahoma, they suppressed the information. They did not want. I mean, if they could have hid that horrible situation. But see, unlike Rosewood, they just eliminated Rosewood. Rosewood is no more. See, so you could suppress that. But Tulsa is still a city. So what happened there? What happened to the people? What happened to this, that, and the other? See, that was still there. But they suppressed it so long, it was not in the history books. It was not discussed in school. Yeah, they didn't want to know about that. Greenwood, Archer, and Pine. The group, the Gap Band. It's from Tulsa, Greenwood, Archer, and Pine. In fact, one of their songs is, "You dropped a bomb on me. You dropped a bomb." In fact, you know, it's a love song basically saying the betrayal that you dropped a bomb on me and it kind of hurt my feelings and so forth. But also it can mean you dropped a bomb on me because that's what happened in Tulsa. It's the first time that in a city in the United States was attacked from the air the first time. And ironic, the second time it happened in Philadelphia against the MOVE organization. And both times they were African communities. Both times. But the brother who was in Tulsa said there were at least a dozen planes or more dropping bombs, and he said you could see the buildings being burned from the rooftops. So you know what that's about. Greenwood is an historic freedom colony in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Has one of the most prominent concentrations of American and African businesses in the United States during the early 20th century. It was popularly known as America's Black Wall Street until the Tulsa Massacre of 1921, in which Caucasian residents massacred as many as 300 residents, injuring hundreds more and razing the neighborhood within hours. The massacre was one of the most devastating in the history of the United States as far as race relations, destroying the once thriving Greenwood community. Within 10 years after the massacre, surviving residents who chose to remain in Tulsa tried to rebuild the district. They accomplished this despite the opposition from many Caucasians, political and business leaders, and the punitive rezoning laws enacted to prevent the reconstruction. It continued as a vital American African community until segregation was overthrown by the federal government during the 1950s and 60s. Desegregation encouraged American African citizens to live and shop elsewhere in the city, causing Greenwood to lose much of its original vitality. Since then, city leaders have attempted to encourage other economic development activities elsewhere, and that's what happens. You know, I don't know, you know, if you're the age that I am, and, you know, when you've lived and you can think about your city, or if you lived in a city, if you lived in a city of any size, no matter what, here in America, it doesn't matter what side of the city. If you had money, if your people were well off, you'll have a different perspective. But most of the people, particularly even if you were well off, you probably could not live in a suburban area that was created. You had to see, a lot of times for us, we lived in a community, even though it was not all that, but we still had the teacher there, maybe even a doctor or a lawyer there, a dentist there, living within the city. But then once the 50s and the 60s and open housing and the end of segregation, see ya. So those communities became devastated with the loss of people with wherewithal who had money. They became devastated. And of course, Tulsa and other cities who had succumbed to Caucasians vamping on them and destroying them, sometimes to the point of eliminating them like they did Rosewood, that there would be no more. I'm going to come back. When we come back, I'm going to further go off into this. Like I said, I have been invited as part of a delegation. And the reason why it's me, because the brother who's a state rep, he was a firefighter. He was a firefighter. And he, Brother Matthews, he came to our training program that we have at Dillard University, and myself and a few others, we teach a history of us. At least I teach a history of us as a people. One brother from New York, now living in Virginia Beach, he teaches the history of us in the fire service and many others. And so he asked for us to come to Tulsa and to discuss the commemoration next year of this horrific event, and how to put it into the schools and so forth. So I'll be there this weekend doing that. When I come back on Monday, I will talk about that and other things. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back from that break, we'll have more discussions. And you can join this discussion by dialing 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on TimeForAnAwakening.com and BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. You stay with us.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at TimeForAnAwakening@gmail.com.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media, this program, of course, is every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. After this program on Mondays from 6 p.m. to 8 is Acres of Diamonds, followed by Let's Buy Black 365 from 8 to 9, and then Conversations, Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey. And on Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10. And then on Wednesday, this evening from 8 to 10, Revive with Sister POC, Proof of Consciousness from 8 to 10. And then on Thursdays, Relationships with Joy and Troy at 7 p.m. And then on Friday at 8 p.m., Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And then on Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. time, it's Revive with Sister POC once again from 11 to 1 on Sunday. And then Sunday evening, Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard at 7 p.m. on Sunday. And every Monday through Friday from 10 p.m. Eastern to 12 a.m., it's the Warren Ballantyne Show right here on Time for an Awakening Media. And the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Back to our discussion on, I'm going to take a call, and I have a caller here, 646-646, good afternoon.
About your true value, the value you barely hear yourself.
Is that right? My volume is, I need to turn it up some? Okay,
yeah,
thank
you. Definitely need to turn it up. Turn it up.
Okay, I'm going to turn it up, man. I don't want to be misinterpreted or misunderstood or not heard.
That's what happens regardless.
Yeah.
You know, especially the way the climate is today. What are you discussing today? What's your topic?
I'm talking about the massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 1921. I am leaving tomorrow. Okay. I'm going to Tulsa, Oklahoma to be part of a contingency who are going to Oklahoma to talk about the massacre and how to present it and so forth. And the reason why I'm going is because the brother who's a state legislator, he also was a firefighter, and he attended our program in we used to be here in Atlanta, too, but in New Orleans at Dillard University. And I do a history piece. And so myself and four other people, we're going to be there in Tulsa to talk about.
When is the program?
Pardon?
When is the program?
Oh, I don't know. Sometime next year, since next year is the 100th commemoration of, Black Wall Street. So I'm going to get a chance to see some of these places and see what happened and get firsthand information that I'll definitely be bringing back to the broadcast. And so Monday's program, I talked about other massacres that happened to our people when Caucasians out of spite or no reason at all, or under the disguise of us having to accosted or assaulted or raped a white woman, vamped on our community to, steal and take and burn and pillage and murder our people,
it's interesting if you think about it, how we've evolved over this 100 years from that type of tragedy to where we are now. And if you honestly was to tell the truth,
we're worse.
Our projection as a people
is worse.
Was better back then, and yes, our development on trying to become solvent than it is today. Because now all the Negro wants to do is be in the arms of the daddy.
Yeah.
There's no communities now like what was happening then. Even though the climate was probably different and things were different, we had to be more self-sustaining
I agree.
In a sense than what we are today. But today, you can't even get people together to even do that now. And then you have people like the Nation of Islam talking about separation or else. And like I always say, why don't you get your members together and do it and show it and then come to the people? Why you got to come to the people beforehand to get involved with your situation? For what reason? I don't understand it. It's just something that's mind-boggling to me because, you know, the bottom line is nobody wants to admit it or to agree with it. But if anybody thinks that they're going to go into a situation like that and not live under the governance and the principles of the Nation of Islam, you's a damn fool. Because there's no way in God's earth they're going to be involved in anything as the so-called facilitator of it, the idea, and not be over it. You're just stupid and dumb, and you deserve whatever you get by placing yourself and your family in that bull sugar honey iced tea, because that's all it is. Because if it wasn't, they would have already did it by now, because they've been talking about it for over 60, 70 years. You know, and we just need to be frank and honest about it instead of people trying to placate and place you in the position of bull sugar honey iced tea.
Well, you know, the thing is that, and I remember attending some Republic of New Africa meetings back in the 60s myself, and in fact, being a person who understands the Republic of New Africa as well as in COBRA, the National Coalition for Blacks for Reparations in America, all these organizations, I love them, you know. But the reality is, in COBRA particularly, no, excuse me, Republic of New Africa particularly, because I just don't see that happening. In fact, I wouldn't argue to be in the midst of an open and sworn enemy to try to develop sovereignty, to try to develop a real place for us as a people, understanding the history. I mean, you know, Black Wall Street is a prime example, but there's so many others.
Yep.
There's so many others, you know. That once we had something and it was solid ours and we didn't have to rely on the European for nothing and he's right there looking at it, you know? So
I mean, you know, I asked this question. Now, I mean, I believe, and I may be wrong or I may be right, I don't think that there's never been another nationality that has been allowed to form anything like it in this country without the white man going in there and at some point in time destroying it because of their envy, their greed, and things of that nature. Even though it's different now that you have other nationalities that have communities in this country, but I don't think nobody's ever been able to really do what the brothers and sisters did in Tulsa and at some point in time not been attacked. I could be wrong. I don't know. Let us know.
Well, let me just say this. There are other communities that have been able to do some things within themselves to provide some jobs, some businesses. I can think of the Indian communities. I can think of Latino communities. I can think of Asian communities that have done that, but they never stated or they never proposed themselves to be independent. They never said that they're outside of the United States. They paid their taxes. They did this and that. They did what they had to do, but that community was theirs.
Did the brothers and sisters in Tulsa do that? Did they try to make it seem like they was independent of the United States government? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. I just think that they knew that because of segregation, because of all the things that they experienced, they knew that they had to have something of their own, and that's what they did. They created, you know, the Greenwood, Archer, and Pine, or the Greenwood community of Tulsa, you know, and it was self-sustaining.
Because, you know, the reality is the perfect example of that would be the Chinese that came over here to build out west.
Right.
And then from there, they developed their own communities that, to be honest, have probably been sustained till this day.
Right.
You know what I mean? Not that they've grown as big as one would imagine. No, they probably haven't. But
no.
You have substantial communities of Asians out west, you know what I mean, that have been able to survive. I was reading something about there's a fight now going on out in San Francisco in regards to the Chinese community and it sustaining themselves, and it's been there for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
For, you know, hundreds of years. But listen, Oshi, just if you could do something with the value or two, then I'll let you continue what you're doing, man. And you as always, you're doing a phenomenal job, brother. You're trying to put forward information that our people need to understand the plight that we're in, because it's going to get harder and harder and harder, man. We're in for some serious times, man. And, you know, we got to start looking about how we're going to help our children survive in the future, because this is about to get crazy in this country. And I'm sorry to say, most of our people are not prepared or in a position to survive what's coming in the years ahead. So hold up, brother. And,
all right, there, brother.
You know, I'll get back to you later.
Okay,
hold up.
Peace. All right, thank you, Jay. Appreciate you. And you know, Jay's right. I mean, there's some Chinese communities and a number of Chinatowns in various cities. That and in that area, in fact, there's some cities that, you know, you can see the language on the buildings. But that was like that too, you know, for European Jews. There's some Yiddish on the buildings and in some Puerto Rican communities, you know. And even, you know, there were some small communities. Like I said, if you have grown up as an American African and in a decent sized city, and you remember that how those communities were. I remember, you know, the things that were happening. Although there was in Milwaukee serious segregation to this very day. It wasn't like that was passed. It's happening still today. But I remember businesses and so forth, and of course all of that has changed. And now there's gentrification. Some of these places, just like what I've read about in Tulsa, you know, they're trying to move back in and take some areas that, you know, and build some things that they know that will be out of our price range, you know, here in Atlanta, gentrification. So Tulsa will require its schools to teach the Tulsa Massacre of 1921. Oklahoma's Education Department is adding the 1921 massacre to its curriculum for the first time in a move that doubles as a contingency to stop the tragedy's centennial from devolving into a pile on of the state's failure to fully reckon with the tragedy. CNN reports that the decision was announced on Wednesday with State Senator Kevin Matthews. That's the brother that I know. That's why. He's the one who was a former firefighter, State Senator Kevin Matthews. Said describing the 99-year-old killings as Tulsa's dirty secret, students from elementary through high school will be required to learn about them starting this fall. I wonder if that's this fall. A pilot program ran by the Tulsa Public Schools has provided a blueprint for how the incident will be taught and helped administrators develop tools and resources to ensure that teachers are comfortable teaching it. Until now, lessons about the massacre have been inconsistent. Some schools taught it, some didn't. Its universalization this week marks something of a turnaround in how its centrality to Oklahoma's history is understood. It also not the only related effort. Last year, Tulsa Mayor G.T. Bynum, a Republican, had a team of scientists and forensic anthropologists investigate a structural anomaly in the Oaklawn Cemetery, located a few blocks from Tulsa's Greenwood District, which was known eloquently in the early 1920s as Black Wall Street. The anomaly was first discovered in the late 1990s and seemed to indicate the presence of a mass grave. "We owe it to the community to determine if there was a mass grave in our city," Bynum stated. According to the Washington Post, "We owe it to the victims and their families." Earlier this month, officials agreed to permit limited excavations in the cemetery to determine whether or not the anomalies contained the bodies of people killed in 1921. Sorry. I apologize. Thank you. They certify that there are no corrupt plans to exhume the researchers' findings. Taken in tandem, the curriculum overhaul and the mass grave search seem to comprise an overdue difference on the part of local officials as to the event whose magnitude and devastation had long been underrepresented and underappreciated. The broad strokes of what happened in Tulsa in 1921 are perhaps more widely known today than ever before, owing in part to a fictionalization depiction of the tragedy in HBO's Watchmen series. It commenced on May 31st of 1921, when rumors circulated that a brother named Dick Rowland had sexually assaulted a Caucasian woman, Sarah Page, in an elevator. The allegations crystallized what widely understood as a broader set of interracial resentments, namely those of Tulsa's Caucasian residents toward the American African citizens of Greenwood, a thriving business district marked by an unusual concentration of American African wealth. Caucasians laid siege to the area, cordoning off its border so that American African people had trouble even evacuating and shooting those that were trapped, to set fire to around 40 blocks of homes and businesses, torching buildings from the ground while using airplanes to firebomb Greenwood from the sky. 48 hours later, 2 days, more than 300 of us were killed and 10,000 were left homeless. Those efforts to revitalize the Greenwood District over the subsequent century have come in spurts. Of late, they've even widely criticized for directing the spoils of redevelopment away from those who should have benefited the most, from the Post. So they tried to do some revitalization, but not around there. And then now, from what I also read, they're trying to do that, but it seems to be it's not for us. Tulsa prepares to commemorate the massacre centennial in 2021. A community still haunted by its history is being transformed by a wave of new development in and around Greenwood. There's a minor league baseball stadium and plans for a BMX motocross headquarters. There's an art district marketed to millennials and a hip shopping complex constructed out of empty shipping containers. There's a high-end apartment complex with a yoga studio and a pub. So you can see this is not about us. While almost two-thirds of the neighborhood residents are American Africans, the gentrification has surfaced tensions between the present and the past. This tension hints at a common dynamic that often complicates some historical commemorations, that the sincerity and reverence from which they're pursued by some is in many ways offset by their parallel function as a sort of capital-driven, boosterism. To quote Richard Rose, college professor and longtime Memphis Zenonia Robinson, designed to remark that their location sullied image to appear to potential investors. One can only hope that Oklahoma's broadening education around the 1921 massacre has an indication by its inclusion in the state's curriculum will produce minds better equipped to reckon with and offset it as previous generations have been. And because they didn't know. They didn't want nobody to know. It's been there, just as Brother Matthew said, Tulsa's Dirty Secret. And I remember about 20 years ago watching Nightline when they brought it up again about the massacre. And there was an Oklahoma legislator who was adamant about really nothing being done about it. He didn't even want a damn marker. He was saying it happened, get over it. Definitely was not down with any kind of restitution, reparations, none of that. There was a sister named Hooker. I think it was Olivia Hooker. She was 4 or 5 years old when it happened. She just died. She died last year, I believe. No, 2 years ago, 2018. She was 100-something years old. And she was holding out hope to see some kind of justice, some kind of recognition that the state of Oklahoma, the city of Tulsa, would recognize they're wrong and try to compensate to do something right. It still hasn't happened. And as far as I'm concerned, it's not going to happen. Not in the way that it should, but these efforts, you know, to educate, to inform, you know, even like when they tried to rebuild, it was a shadow and a shell of itself. In fact, it wound up being pretty much nothing. Because, you know, brothers and sisters who had more money, they moved out. They shopped elsewhere. You know, they go to the more, you know, publicized mall. They go to the mall where there's more stores and highlights and so forth, you know. So that's the reality, you know, just like here. Right down the street from me on the West End, that mall is hanging on, but I've seen the design. My daughter sent me a piece of what they're planning on for happening in the West End, which is, of course, us. But it's going to be gentrified. They're going to make that mall. They're going to make that mall into a multi-use facility with shops and apartments and so forth. You know, just like in Milwaukee, they made some new libraries. Library at the bottom with, you know, living quarters on top. They did that. They did three buildings like that. In fact, they did our old hall, the Brotherhood Hall that we had, the Black Firefighters. We had a hall. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to leave, because we gave it up. I do believe if we really put forth a fight and had the community behind us, we didn't have to lose that hall. We really did. But because we did, and a number of other things, the festival wasn't happening, and some other things, I was like, man, I got to go. You know, that worst winter, it was that bad winter of 2013, and then coupled with all those other dynamics, that was a signal for me. My grandson's health got better. That was a signal for me. It's time for me to go. It's time for me to go. You know, and pretty soon it'll be time for me to go again. And although my daughters, they don't want me to go, no more. Man, I'm out of here. I am out of here. I could do this radio program from wherever, you know, that's for sure. But understanding that the situation in Tulsa, it's not going to get any better. Well, I'm going to Tulsa. I'm going to see what things that, I mean, I shouldn't say that. I'm going to go see for myself what's happening with the brothers and sisters in Tulsa, what things they are doing, you know. So I can't wait, you know. Take some pictures of stuff. And so here's another article that I have. And this is the Tulsa massacre, when a Caucasian mob burned down Black Wall Street to the ground. Black Wall Street was once the United States' wealthiest American African neighborhood, but during the Tulsa massacre of 1921, a Caucasian mob destroyed the whole thing in just one day. Just one day. Black Wall Street, that was the nickname given to Greenwood, a 1 square mile neighborhood full of wealthy American African families in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ever since the oil boom of the early 20th century, doctors, lawyers, business persons thrived in the affluent suburb until the Tulsa Massacre of 1921, when their homes were burned to the ground. See, it says a race riot. I refuse to say that because that's not what it was. It was a massacre. They vamped on that community. You know, when that brother was alleged to have done that, he said he tripped and fell, and, you know, I don't know if somebody or she said, but he said he apologized. Based upon the report, he apologized multiple times, and it was no deal. And but then the headlines in the Oklahoma Tulsa paper, you know, nab the cat that accosted the white woman in the elevator. You know, go get him, and you know, so you now you got to whip this crowd up. And so some brothers, the brother was in, he was in jail. He was in jail. Dick Rowland, he was in jail. And some brothers, having come back from World War I, they still had weapons. And so they were protecting. So the mob wouldn't bum rush to jail. They were protecting him, standing outside the jail. And so they were confronted. And all you need is one. That's right. One shot rang out. It was on. It was on. And I think only about 5 or 6 Caucasians died. But over 300. First, the news report was only like 30 of us had died, you know? But once again, they said they had a community of about 10,000 people at that time. And all of them were homeless. They had those Red Cross tents. And of course, from what I understand, that the Red Cross did not give an accurate counting, but who knows? Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, you know? And some were still in those tents during the winter months, because this happened in June, the last days of May and the first day of June of 1921. Sometimes called the Tulsa Massacre, that's what I call it, because that's what it was. See, I can say a race riot would be one group against another group. This is just people, Caucasians, vamping on us. We weren't against them. We were trying to protect ourselves. Started when a 19-year-old man named Dick Rowland was accused of sexually assaulting a 17-year-old Caucasian lady in an elevator. Rowland insisted that he had simply tripped and accidentally fell on her while on his way to the restroom. The woman, Sarah Page, didn't press charges, but the community was livid. One newspaper ran a story with this headline, "Nab Negro for Attacking Girl in Elevator." A mob gathered in an attempt to lynch him, but the American African men of Greenwood wouldn't let it happen. Armed with guns and rifles, some 30 residents set up a barricade outside the police station where Rowland was being held. Shots were fired, and it is on. The Tulsa Massacre in Greenwood, Greenwood was founded in 1906. Greenwood was built on what used to be Indian territory. Some American Africans used to be captives of some of those tribes or nations, were finally able to integrate into the local communities and even bought their own land. Wealthy American African landowner O.W. Gurley was one who purchased 40 acres of land in Tulsa and named it Greenwood. But he did not keep it all to himself or all his money. Gurley soon began loaning money to other American African people who wanted to start businesses in Greenwood. Before long, Black Wall Street began to thrive on American African salespersons and their loyal customers alone. It didn't take long for racist, angry Caucasians to notice the prosperous community of Greenwood, and they weren't too happy about it. Arguably, the widespread resentment bubbling beneath the surface made Tulsa massacre all the more destructive. Excuse me. Remember, I'm getting over a cold. And, you know, in fact, I can't be coughing on the airplane tomorrow. You know that. You know, I mean, you could back in the day, but you can't do nothing. You can't cough or sneeze, and I understand that. So I probably should take a mask with me because I'm the one that's coming on there with a cold, you know? At least I got remnants of it, but I'm fine, man. A group of men, you show a group of men watching all the devastation and the fires that are happening there, man. Indeed, the Caucasian men of Tulsa unleashed their fury on that community. On June 1st, 1921, thousands of rioters went through Greenwood shooting, killing, destroying property, burning down homes. They destroyed businesses and looted buildings, essentially leaving the town in ruins. Over the course of just one day, the rioters, the Caucasians, collectively burned down almost all of Black Wall Street. As an American African attorney, Buck Coburn Franklin wrote while white witnessing the event, "I could see planes circling in the midair. They grew in number and hummed, darted and dipped low. I could hear something like hail falling onto the top of my building. Down East Archer, I saw the old Midway Hotel on fire, burning from its top, and then another building began to burn from their top. Lurid flames roared and belched and licked their forked tongues in the air. Smoke ascended the sky in thick black volumes, and amidst it all, the planes, now a dozen or more in number, still humming and darting here and there with the agility of natural birds in air. The sidewalks were literally covered with burning turpentine balls. I knew all too well where they came from, and I knew all too well why every burning building first caught fire from the top. I paused and waited for an opportunity of time to escape. Where is our splendid firefighters? Where is our splendid fire department with its half dozen station? I asked myself, is the city in conspiracy with this mob? Oh yeah, it is. The police department, all of them, they conspired, all of them vamped on the Greenwood section. They were even the guard came and they were arresting us. It didn't take long before Oklahoma's governor declared martial law, bringing the National Guard to end the violence. But some say the police and the guard actually joined in on the fights, dropping sticks of dynamite from planes and firing machine guns into swarms of American residents. In 24 hours, it was all over, but the damage had already been done. The grisly aftermath, American African men marched down the street, guns pointed at their backs. Going to these American Red Cross tents for them to be housed. By the morning, Greenwood was nothing more than ashes on the ground. Initial reports claimed that 35 died in the riots. But more recently, an investigation by the Massacre Commission argued that the death toll was actually closer to 300,000 more injured. More than 6,000 men and women had been arrested and detained by the National Guard. They were only released if a Caucasian employer or a Caucasian citizen who would vouch for them. Some of the men were held longer than 10 days. More than 35 blocks on the street had been burned, which led to more than 1.5 million in property damage. Today, that would equate to almost $30 million. Among Greenwich residents who survived, nearly all, around 10,000, were left completely homeless. Overnight, the wealthiest American African families went from living in a thriving, well-educated suburb to huddling for warmth in crude Red Cross tents. Within days of the massacre, the American African community tried to start rebuilding. And yet, thousands of those brothers and sisters who were forced to spend the winter in 1921 and 1922 in those same flimsy tents. Although Greenwood was eventually rebuilt, it would never be the same again. And many people who lived there would never truly recover from the trauma and the chaos. Meanwhile, the case against Dick Nolan would later be dismissed. Sarah Page, the Caucasian young lady in the elevator, did not appear as a complaining witness against Roland in court, perhaps the main reason why the case didn't go anywhere. It remains a mystery what happened to Dick Roland after he was exonerated. Some say that after his release, he immediately left Tulsa for Kansas City. That would certainly not be surprising, especially considering what had happened in Tulsa. As described in the 1921 New York Times article, days after the riot, or the massacre, as I say, a city judge ordered a complete restitution and rehabilitation of the destroyed Black Belt. The rest of the United States, this is what the judge said, the rest of the United States must know that the real citizenship of Tulsa weeps at this unspeakable crime and will make good the damage so far as it can be done to the last penny, the judge stated. And yet, that never happened. As I said, I saw a piece from this Caucasian legislator about 20-some years ago. He said, I ain't for that. It's over. Statute of limitations, you know. There is no statute of limitations on murder. Just like the UN, the United Nations, and this tribunal against the captivity of our people. These are crimes against humanity. There are no statute of limitations against crimes against humanity. An all-Caucasian jury would later blame us for the lawlessness in a series of recriminations. The Caucasian men of Tulsa burned down homes and killed people like dogs in the streets, and not one single person ever was prosecuted. Not one. And that's like that in many others that I talked about, the places I talked about this past Monday. The destruction they have done, the things they have done, not one. And despite being the worst massacre in Oklahoma's history, the Tulsa Massacre was nearly erased from national memory forever. It wasn't until 1971 that Impact Magazine editor Don Ross published one of the first accounts of the massacre. This was 50 years after it happened, 1921, 1971. And now we're coming on 100 years. According to NPR Radio, Ross is often credited with being among the first to bring national attention to this forgotten piece of history. At the turn of the 21st century, 80 years after the event, the commission was started, would issue a report and demand that survivors receive reparations. Still, both district courts and the U.S. Supreme Court would deny that request, saying that the statute of limitations had been worn out. The legacy of the massacre, even though the survivors didn't win reparations, organizations such as the Tulsa Historical Society are working towards a new goal, raising awareness of the massacre's existence and significance. Shockingly, the Tulsa Massacre was not part of Oklahoma's public school curriculum until 2000, and an overview of the event was only recently added to the general American history books. And yet, some survivors of the Tulsa, Olivia Hooker, Miss Hooker, kept holding out for justice despite the many disappointments. We thought we might live long enough to see something happen. Even though I've lived 99 years, nothing of that sort has actually happened, Ms. Hooker said, who was 6 years old at the time. And she told us to the news agency, Al Jazeera, we keep hoping. You keep hope alive, so to speak. She'd passed November of 2018 at the age of 103. Demario Solomon Simmons, an American African attorney, isn't optimistic about justice being served anytime soon. Of the last remaining survivors, he said, it's sad to know that they probably will go to die without receiving anything. Unfortunately, American African life in America is still not worth that much. It never was. It is not worth that much now, and it never will be when you live in the kind of system that we live in. Give me a call at 215-490-9832. Give us your African perspective, or your opinions, comments, or concerns of what we're talking about today, and that is what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma. What happened in Tulsa. And believe me, it's sad, but it's real. Tulsa, the massacre of Tulsa is indicative of what happens to African people when we truly come together. Remember, I stated that Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zygmunt Brzezinski, stated in an article that I remember very well. The article was in the Daily Paper in Milwaukee. He said, we will do everything possible to prevent Africans on the continent and Africans in the diaspora from ever forming unity, coalescing, developing a unified front from happening. Do everything in our power to prevent that. And because of, when I read that, what was that, in the early 80s? What's that, 30-something years ago? That now, because of what they have done to us, for some of us, we are so whitewashed. We're so Europeanized. We suffer from the Urugu virus. You know, that idea, that concept of what we did in Tulsa, because we had to. We had to. If coming out of our captivity, and if Caucasians would have said, you know what, we are going to be real. We recognize what we've done was wrong. We're going to open up areas, and you can even live in near our areas if you can afford that. Whatever the case may be, we're going to have a true society where people's values are respected, people's humanity is protected, people who will be treated with common courtesy and respect and dignity. And if you are the better man, you are the better man. No, they were not going to have a society where people were judged by one yardstick. They were not going to have a society where your skin color, your hair texture, your broadness of your nose, the thickness of your lips was not going to be noticed and to be scrutinized to the point where you would be denied. We're not going to do that. We're going to continue to have societies where we dominate, we control. And because of that, when we did what we did and were successful at doing it, oh, they were mad. They were upset. They wanted to destroy it. They wanted to move in on our community and destroy it. I'm anxious to see what it looks like today. Some of the things that they have around there. John Hope Franklin, the historian John Hope Franklin, was also from Tulsa. He lived at that time. And he have a park. They have a park in his honor, the John Hope Franklin Reconciliation Park, you know. You know, these reconciliations, just like South Africa, you know, just like here. Yeah, so you see, I'm lost for words on this because it's just, you know, they've done what they've done, and yet and still, they're not held responsible for the inhumanity that they have put in, that they have placed on us. They're not held responsible. Man. So, I will work with all those brothers and sisters, but I would say this, you know, I don't sugarcoat nothing. If you heard this program before, you know that. That's not me. I ain't sugarcoating nothing. My contention is that, you know, you will, my contention is that, hey, that, yeah, you know, it happened. And so this is what's going to happen. Yeah, it happened. And y'all did it. So what you going to do? You know? What are you going to do? So, I don't know. I can't wait to be a part of that and see what's happening. And like I said, even if it's in the school, obviously there's age appropriateness. But if you're talking about a situation where, you know, we have been so wronged, it's hard to even put that into some words for a third grader, fourth grader, that would be palatable. It is what it is. It's just like what the Europeans did. You know, instead of telling them they came here, we came here, we were met by people who were here, but we said we discovered this. And then the people who were here, they helped us, we helped them. And then one day in the fall, we had a Thanksgiving and it was all nice. And then we wanted to have more land and they were amenable to it. And so they left and they went westward and we kept expanding westward too. And so they kept having to move further west and so forth. And even though we might've had some skirmishes, but they understood that it was okay because we just wanted to expand. We wanted this land to be ours. You know, because we had the idea that we had manifest destiny. We had manifest destiny. You know, it was our birthright. It was our, you know, God had ordained us to do this, to be able to do this, to subdue this land. God, our God, you know, had shown us the way, you know. And even though we eventually put people on parcels of land that we said they can be on, and we didn't care about whatever ancestral lands that they had or any rights that they had, but we said, and I'm definitely talking about me, you know that. I'm speaking in the third person of Caucasians. They said that we have these rights, and this is what we're going to do. And so those history books reflect something different because I remember, you know, when Thanksgiving time came around, putting the damn hat on, paper mache hat or something with some sticky tape or whatever, or putting an Indian headdress on. I remember that. I hope that still doesn't happen, but I believe that it does. I remember, in fact, that the truth is just now being told. The truth is just now being told. So, you know. Well, brothers and sisters, I'm going to end this program. We end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants and think they can't do without and don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, so we end this program and we thank you for listening. Shemhotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Brothers and sisters, have a blessed and wonderful day. Bibi Fahodie means our victorious destiny. When we unite, we will be victorious. We will. Peace, family.